Well, again, happy Mother's Day to mothers here today. I realize that sometimes this day is fraught for some of us, as Father's Day is. And interestingly enough, though it became an unstoppable train, the person who thought of the idea of Mother's Day came to regret Mother's Day as it developed and Madison Avenue got its claws into it. So my sermon today, John 14 part 2 is the straight up title, I guess, but there's a subtitle: To Get to Truth, Let Love Show the Way. To get to truth, let love show the way. Or maybe from our first reading, how to not fear what they fear. In the 18th century, there lived an Anglican clergyman in the south of England named Thomas Bayes. He wasn't well known in his lifetime, but the theory that bears his name, some of you I know are far more familiar with its outworking than I am, Bayes' theorem, has been widely influential in better understanding and calculating statistical probabilities, amongst other things. It's been used to better predict what medical tests are telling us. It helped the group at Bletchley Park build a computer that unraveled Enigma, helping the Allies win the war. And it's very important in modern AI development. So anytime somebody says, you know, you Anglican clergy are basically irrelevant, I can always just say, Bayes. It's been so influential that many claim that Bayesian reasoning is simply the way the human brain and human learning happens. We start with a viewpoint, then we weigh the probabilities, and as new information comes, we adjust our viewpoint, weigh the probabilities anew. It's kind of like a mathematical way, and I'm not a maths guy, of saying humans learn by experience. And it seems, just on the face of it, true, and its impact on technical advances is undeniable. It was an understanding of learning that fit hand in glove with the Enlightenment's emphasis on practical reason. But then along came Sigmund Freud, and he reminded us that human learning seems far more dependent on drives and conditioning that are largely invisible to us. Our primary way of living is to react emotionally and not weigh probabilities reasonably. I just had somebody in my first service say to me as they were leaving the door, somebody who does presentations, say, but the data says, everyone's going the other direction. Reactivity is helpful in a limited number of instances of life, life-threatening situations, but it overreaches, as we know. It teaches us that if we're cheated by someone tall, dark, and beautiful or handsome, that we probably shouldn't trust someone who looks like that. In the church, if a bishop or a priest or a warden said something to us once that was judgmental or wrong or mean, it can stick to us like the smell of onions in a hot kitchen. I actually had a person who I didn't know say to me once, "You look like someone I can't trust." Hey, it sounds it might be true. It sounds awful and it's no fun, but in some ways the person who said that to me was healthier than someone who just doesn't trust and doesn't know why. At least it's a level of self-awareness that we could work with. And so the good news part of this story is that we built a good relationship. And I get how this happens to us. If someone cuts me off in traffic, it may not be that they're being malicious, just like the last guy, or as I imagine the last guy was. Maybe they just didn't see me. Maybe they misjudged the distance between me and them. But I get the same fight or flight reaction, regardless of what their motivation was. In the gospel text today, Jesus knows, given what he's been saying about what will happen to him, which is caused, of course, by reactivity in the religious leaders and their Roman overlords, that his friends are similarly in reactive mode. And so these flowery-sounding words we've just read in our gospel reading aren't really words of instruction, so much as a promise that these ways of being human together, ways we've all felt and known, are not the end of the story. The good news of God in the New Testament is not just an interesting, hopeful religious teaching. It's the promise of a presence that will enable a new way of living. And at the heart of this presence with us, this new way of living, is love. Not just the idea of God's love, but the experience of the love of God. And so Jesus says, if you love me, you will keep my commandments. You'll recall that after washing his disciples' feet, Jesus tells them that he's giving them a new commandment, one commandment, that they love each other as he's loved them. And as some of you have reminded me, Mark Evans has been the one who talked to me about this quite a bit, that this new commandment actually puts a face and experience on the great commandment to love God completely and neighbor as self. And it would have done so for the first followers of Jesus. It would have taken a generality and made it real. And to be part of a community that is attempting this is our version of Jesus' face and experience informing ours. Last week we heard Alex share his experience of God's love in this community and how it changed him in significant ways. And I will give you another advocate who will be with you forever. Jesus has been their advocate. Now he's leaving, and they will be alone, so they think. Another advocate, someone like him. I will not leave you orphaned, he says. Those are powerful words. We will know him, and he will be in us. It's all quite extraordinary, and I mean, I wouldn't be a priest if I didn't believe it's also quite real. We know this just naturally from raising our own children. When we give them security and attachment, when we forgive them and cheer them on, they're able to make better decisions. We don't tell them to think in the Bayesian way. We love them. And somehow this makes it easier for them to know the truth and their life's path. And of course, we do teach them to think rationally from that basis. Stereotypically, we associate this kind of love with our mothers, whom our society has decided to honor this day. But of course, sometimes we experience this through our fathers or both our parents or neither. I always wondered why my bond with my mother felt so tepid, so distant. When I became an adult, I discovered through her own vulnerability, telling me, a chain of events. My great-grandmother experienced a hellacious time in Russia, of course, hunted by Stalin's KGB, and was cold and distant from my grandmother. I hadn't known why. All I knew is that my grandmother was bitterly critical and coldly distant from my mother. And I experienced that on occasion, even as a child. And interestingly, my mother was neither of those things. She was kind and sensitive and not self-centered. And yet I didn't have a close attachment with her. But then my mother, in her late 40s, had a charismatic, there's no other way to say it, a charismatic experience of God's love in community that largely healed her. She was still quite suspicious of religious authorities, still quite aware that she lived in a patriarchal culture and society. I get some of my critical nature from her. But even with that, she finally knew she wasn't an emotional orphan. That God loved her just the way she was, and that she had gifts to share. She was an educator by vocation, and after these experiences in this community, she became a teacher of prayer and shared in conferences around the world and in our city. And without exaggeration, though this never happened for me personally, because, you know, once you miss those opportunities as a kid, it's really hard to recreate them, but she became a dearly beloved matriarchal figure who made deep attachments with people. Not because she was a great speaker, but because she experienced God's acceptance and presence and God's gift of being a dearly loved daughter. When we are secure in God's love, we don't have to prove ourselves. We don't have to put on airs or strut our stuff. We don't have to wall ourselves off from facts we don't like. We can just be. And this acceptance provides the way to regulate our reactivity, to not project onto others our fears and suspicions. Though this takes time, as it will for the disciples and for every community I've ever been in, it takes time and many mistakes and fallbacks will happen. But the new way, a new way in community has started, and it changes everything. I could have subtitled this sermon not "Let Love Show the Way," but "Let Love Slow the Way." For we learn Christ's love in community in the midst of human reactiveness, which we all still have, in the midst of suffering, which we all experience, and yet with this hope of something new amongst us as well. Julian of Norwich, the 14th century English mystic who we celebrated this past week and whose book, Revelations of Divine Love, is one of the great mystic texts of our tradition. She said this, is one of her quotes, "The mother's service is nearest, readiest, and surest. Nearest, for it is most of nature. Readiest, for it is most of love. And surest, for it is most of truth. This office none might nor could ever do to the full, but he alone, our mother, Christ." The Anglican clergyman Bayes was on to something, I think. Using Bayesian reasoning, or my flimsy understanding of it, we could say that in all probability that once we experience God's love in community, our viewpoint will change. The new information we take in will seem less threatening to us. We will be less afraid and ashamed to be known for who we are, warts and all. Amen.